Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. These are challenging times, to say the very least, for General Motors. Toyota just tipped GM out of its spot as world's largest automaker. At its annual shareholder meeting yesterday, GM had to celebrate that it only lost $2 billion last year. In Washington today, its CEO is begging Congress not to ask too much better gas mileage from its cars. But there is one car GM is dying to talk about. Its coming soon electric plug-in and maybe its savior, the Chevy Volt. We'll talk in a moment with General Motors' Bob Lutz, but first, joining me from Washington for the latest on GM and a hot debate on Capitol Hill over fuel efficiency this week is Dave Shepherdson, Washington correspondent for the Detroit News. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So tell us about the big CEOs in town to talk about fuel efficiency there. Who's in Washington today, and what are they asking for?
Well, it's the CEOs of General Motors, Ford, and Daimler Chrysler's Chrysler Group. They're pushing for a more modest increase in fuel economy that the Senate is about to consider next week, a 40% increase in fuel economy requirements by 2020, which the automakers contend would cost them tens of billions of dollars and would basically have little or no chance of complying without having to scale back many of their largest products.
What are the CEOs asking for then if they don't think they can hit that high efficiency, that high miles per gallon level?
Well, there's certainly a lot of skepticism here. I mean, the auto companies have been very successful for 20 years in blocking increases in CAFE. I mean, the program started in 1975 when Congress adopted it as a result of the oil embargo, and there hasn't been an increase since 1985 for passenger cars. There was a modest increase last year for light trucks, but I mean, all these companies, Ford, GM, and Chrysler Group, have lost north of $20 billion collectively over the last couple of years. So they're looking for something that will not put them out of business. I mean, they all agree that they have to do more, but the devil's in the details.
There's a lot of heat on the front of doing something about emissions and climate change right now. Do they still have a receptive audience in Washington, or are congressmen and senators pushing back and saying, no, we've got to ask for higher mileage?
Well, there's certainly a lot of proposals here. I mean, take, you know, Chris Dodd, for example, the Connecticut senator, has called for a 50-mile-per-gallon requirement, which, you know, is basically double what we currently have today. You know, the auto industry still has a lot of clout. Yes, they've closed a lot of plants, and they've, especially the domestic companies, have shrunk in size. But even the foreign automakers are in support on a number of key issues. I mean, Toyota and Honda, they see their major growth areas in, you know, larger trucks, and they also don't want to see an onerous increase in fuel economy.
What about Detroit's efforts? We're going to hear in just a moment from the vice chairman of GM, Bob Lutz. What about Detroit's efforts on this front? Dave, you're with the Detroit News. Everybody's watching here. The Toyota Prius, what, just cracked the top 10 in sales in one of the most recent accountings. How's Detroit doing on the green push?
Well, all three Detroit automakers are taking different attacks. But it's important to know, for the last 20 years, vehicles have gotten more efficient. But what automakers have done is put those efficiency gains into making larger cars that are faster, better 0 to 60 times, and more towing capacity. And automakers like GM, they're working on electrifying the car, using a variety of ways to create electricity and run vehicles solely on electricity. Daimler Chrysler's Chrysler Group is focusing on diesels. You know, they sell a lot of diesels in Europe. Ford is working on hybrids. They have the Ford Escape hybrid. But let's remember that not all the hybrids are successful. I mean, Honda just announced yesterday that they're going to stop selling the Honda Accord hybrid.
Just not enough sales, they
said. Not enough sales because the price is still too expensive. Even with $3.50 gas, you know, it's still a big it's a big thing to swallow to have to spend another $5,000-$6,000 on a hybrid.
But do you feel optimism out of Detroit that they can take on, let's say, the Japanese automakers on mileage and win?
What they're going to point out is that in a lot of segments, they are very competitive or even actually beat the Japanese automakers in fuel efficiency. The difference is the Detroit automakers have made a lot of money and most of their profits on selling larger SUVs and pickup trucks. And they would argue that the reason Toyota or Honda have a much better fuel efficiency is because of the mix of small cars versus larger cars. But you know, as Rick Wagner has said, his biggest mistake...
GM CEO, yeah.
His biggest mistake was getting rid of the EV1, and that it allowed Toyota to take the crown as the environmental leader. And
this was the electric car that had the plug pulled in, what, 03 or something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. And I think with the Volt, GM is trying to say, look, you know, we're not going to cede the environmental mantle to anybody. This is something we're really committed to. And internally, GM is going to do everything it takes to get this on the roads by 2010, 2011, and probably for under $30,000.
Well, let's go straight to GM and find out about it. Dave Shepherdson with the Detroit News in Washington, thank you very much for being there.
Thanks, Tom.
Joining me now from Detroit is General Motors Vice Chairman of Product Development, Robert Lutz. He's former chairman of GM North America, an industry icon, spent a lifetime making American cars sleeker and faster and more powerful. He's the father of the Dodge Viper and has now turned his focus to making fuel-efficient cars. He's designed and is now pushing GM's coming soon Chevy Volt, the sleek face of the company's green strategy. Bob Lutz, thanks very much for being with us today.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
Tell us about this car that you're so excited about. What's it got going technologically, and what can it do for the U.S. auto industry? Can it save you?
Well, I think GM is I think the salvation of GM is assured with or without the Volt. And I was very pleased to see that Dave Shepherdson, by the way, did point out that this thing of Asian fuel economy superiority is largely a fiction, and it comes from looking at the average of the vehicle park. And since the Japanese have a history of producing very small vehicles, and we are, the big three are the purveyor of large vehicles, obviously our average fuel economy is not as good. But hey, we produce what the market wants. And at gasoline that was under $2, the fuel bill for the average American as a percent of disposable income was about the lowest in history. And you just can't fault for people wanting a big V8 sport utility if the fuel cost is such that it doesn't really impact their budget.
Well, that's the thing, but people also want to live and thrive, and there's so much attention now on concern about hurricanes and global warming and climate change. We've got 113 models in the world outside the U.S. that drive an average of 40 miles a gallon. Only two of them actually available in this U.S. market, and they're both Japanese, the Prius and the Honda Civic Hybrid.
Right.
what will the Volt do?
But again, back to Dave Shepherdson's point, and I'll get to this in a second. And all of our large trucks and large sport utilities have segment leading fuel economy and beat the equivalent Japanese models by many miles per gallon. And this is never brought out, and it's a subject of great frustration to me that many in the media perpetuate this fiction of Asian superiority and fuel economy. If you look at it, like Dave Shepherdson says, if you look at it head-on vehicle by vehicle, it's simply not accurate.
Well, I mean, we grant you, you're right up there in the most recent numbers with Toyota in sales, partly because your Silverado is past the Ford's F-Series pickup, and you've got some fuel economy in that pickup truck. But nevertheless, as you say, at the fleet level, there's a reason that your CEO's in Washington as we speak, battling not to have higher mileage forced down his throat, and it's not because. But the Volt's supposed to put you ahead of the curve, can it? Will it?
Well, the Volt is a technology leader, and I think initially when we bring the Volt to market, and by the way, it's farther away than any of us would like. Right now, our internal target is sort of second half of calendar year 2010, mm-hmm. which is about the length of any development cycle for an all-new vehicle, except this time we face the additional challenge of making sure the batteries work, they meet the that they meet the cycle lives, that we get the range that we want.
Real
so
new
forth.
Technology to work with.
It's all new. So,
and some of it not even there yet. I mean, you're still putting out contracts to speed it up and make it all production ready, as I understand.
Yeah, exactly. But by selecting our battery development suppliers, which we announced yesterday,
right?
We've really we've passed a major milestone, because we were looking at 13 different battery manufacturers around the world, or potential lithium-ion battery suppliers. We finally settled on these two, and I must say both of these companies believe that what we want to do is feasible. It doesn't require breakthroughs. It doesn't require inventions.
And how big a deal is it for GM and U.S. automaking?
I think we don't know how big this can be yet, but it is a breakthrough car, because it's not a plug-in hybrid. This vehicle is an electric vehicle. It's driven electrically. It has a small gasoline engine that can be used for an emergency generator set if you run your batteries down to
but not to run the car, but to generate more electricity.
To generate more electricity.
Yeah.
And we're shooting for an all-electric range of 40 miles, and including freeway driving at 70 miles an hour. This thing will have a top speed of 100 miles an hour, so it'll be a fully functional automobile.
We're talking this hour with GM's Vice Chairman for Product Development, Bob Lutz. It was the annual shareholders meeting yesterday in Wilmington, Delaware. GM Chairman and CEO Rick Wagner said here, the company's turning around.
As we look forward to GM's centennial celebration next year, we're taking the profound actions necessary to transform the company for the long haul, for sustained profitability and growth, setting us up to be a global leader for years to come.
Centennial celebration coming up, but Bob Lutz, no longer the world's largest automaker. Toyota took that. A lot of hopes being put on this Volt. Tell us more about it. A lot of our listeners will not understand this technology or what's really at work here.
Well, it's basically unlike hybrids, which have drive both through a gasoline engine or an electric motor and batteries, mm-hmm. each of which can alternately power the vehicle. The interesting thing about the Volt is it's basically an all-electric vehicle with a range of about 40 miles. We're actually hoping for a little bit more.
Now, you said 40, but I also read 600 and some. What's that about?
But I'm getting to that.
Okay.
It's 40 miles purely electrically, so that if your commute is less than 40 miles and you can recharge at work, you would never use an ounce of fuel of any kind.
This is after what, plugging it in and charging up that lithium ion battery?
And battery pack, right. And the battery pack goes down the center tunnel of the car and so forth. And
How do I plug it in and charge it? Do I plug it in just, there's a socket at home or a special
Absolutely, kind of? Absolutely. No special sockets, no inductive charging, no complex thing. It will look like a normal extension cord that you plug into a normal AC outlet.
To this big hot car. How long does it take to charge it up?
With 115 volts, it would be a matter of, I think, about 6 hours. If you have 220, it would be half that time.
So overnight is fine.
Oh, absolutely. And while you're at work is fine. And, of course, the reason we like 40 miles is 40 miles covers about 82% of the daily trips in the United States, mm-hmm. which means that people buying 82% of the time would get by on 40 miles a day. Now, what happens after the first 40 miles electrically?
Yeah.
At this point, your battery is down to about a 30% state of charge, and mm-hmm. there we would automatically kick in this very small, very fuel-efficient gasoline engine, which, by the way, could run on E85.
Or that's the ethanol kind of mix of gasoline.
Ethanol, yeah, which is mostly ethanol, only 15% mm-hmm. fossil fuel and much lower on CO2.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could run it on biodiesel, or it could be a small fuel cell. In other words, that secondary emergency generator could be almost anything. And then that will recharge the battery as you drive. So if you do 60 mm-hmm. miles on a trip,
mm-hmm.
You're on batteries. We are on battery for 40, the gasoline engine recharging for 20 miles, and there our simulations show that the average economy for a 60-mile trip mm-hmm. would be about 151 miles per gallon.
And what if I'm driving from Boston to Chicago or Dallas to Phoenix, or a long drive?
Yeah, this is not where the cars... this is not what the car is designed for.
So it's kind of a town car, commuter car,
you can do a 650-mile trip, but then the internal combustion engine would be on quite a lot of the time, constantly recharging the battery, mm-hmm. and that would probably take the average mileage down to about 55 or 56 miles per gallon.
But even at that, that's down in Prius territory, which people...
That is in Prius territory, but as I say, that mm-hmm. is not the efficient operating mode of the vehicle.
Right. Let me ask you...
The efficient operating mode of the vehicle is trips, I would say, optimally 40 miles or less, which... gets you purely mm-hmm. electric, mm-hmm. or 60 miles, which gets you to an average of about 151. One of the interesting challenges of this vehicle is we don't know how the government is going to measure the mileage.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. If you're plugging into the wall, you're getting your electricity there, but that's being generated somewhere. A lot of those generating plants are coal-fired in this country. So have you been able to work out the sort of net here? You may get 100 miles per gallon, but there's still emissions out there somewhere. How do you calculate that?
Well, yeah, that's been the rap on electric vehicles for a long time. And, of course, there is a striving to... make more and more electricity through renewable and non-fossil fuel sources. But even if you factor that, I mean, that same thing is true basically for all plug-in vehicles. Anything that uses electricity has that problem.
But isn't that the bottom line, climate-wise? I mean, that matters, doesn't it? We can't just move the shells. It's not a shell game here that we want to play.
Well, but... using electricity, which in many cases is created from non-fossil fuels, it certainly takes the automobile out of the climate equation and takes it out of the CO2 equation.
So clean up the energy source.
And of course, then, you know, we can't regulate the power generating industry. Somebody else is going to have to look at that. And, you know, if we're really serious about this climate change thing and saving energy, then we also have to look at things like home air conditioning.
Oh, yeah, it's a big
world. We have to look at freezers. We have to look at refrigerators.
We're looking at you, baby. You've got the auto industry.
That's fine. I'm just saying that, you know, global problems require global solutions. And if you buy out-of-season vegetables at your grocery store that have to be flown in at great expense, mm-hmm. there was carbon generated in that, too.
How Buck Rogers is this, Bob Lutz? You don't have this battery in production yet. Is this a kind of pie in the sky, or can you really deliver this at production levels by 2010?
Well... Our own teams say, "Whoa, 2010 is tough," and we say, "Look, what is there about last half 2010 that you don't understand? Mm-hmm. This is your target." As I said, as we talk to the battery suppliers, this will be the first large scale application of lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles. If, by the way, I have two Segways at home.
Mm-hmm.
Segway 2 years ago converted from nickel metal hydride to lithium ion, and
you mean the little buggy with that you ride around on the two wheeler?
Well, we call it a human transporter,
and it's actually a
very very efficient device mm-hmm. for short range human transportation. And if you can use one of those instead of getting in your car and driving a mile, you know, you're doing a lot of good as well.
Yeah,
and I really try to do that, but their shift to lithium ion has been entirely successful, and they're going to share their experience with us. We have two outstanding battery integrators who tell us, this is a new challenge, but it doesn't require any invention or breakthroughs. It's just a normal normal development process. We have to see how these battery packs behave, how long they last. Can they be cooled? What happens in the case of a cell failure? How do you take that cell? What kind of control mechanism do you have to take that cell out of the loop without causing a thermal event? Or
is that a fire?
Shutting? We don't refer to fires. We call them thermal events.
No doubt.
So our lawyers tell us to call it thermal events. At any rate.
Thermal underwear, only different.
You don't want the whole thing to go down because one sells out, you know, like the famous Christmas tree lights.
Right.
But these are all normal engineering problems that we're absolutely convinced can be solved. Mm. And we call it the E-Flex architecture because it's a purely – see, my thesis is we are nearing the end of the road on squeezing more and more efficiency out of conventional cars.
We've
and
seen
that's
that,
one
yeah.
of the reasons that's one of the reasons why we have a problem with the CAFE increases, because we're out of solutions that will get you nice increases for relatively low sums of money.
Yeah, but we're also near the end of the road on global warming, so nobody wants to wait forever, huh?
Well, I understand that. So that's why we tend to espouse transformational solutions, which instead of spending thousands of dollars per car to get modest increments in gas mileage, why not make a max effort at displacing petroleum through the use of electric cars, fuel cell vehicles, or what we're great advocates of ethanol use, which is a biofuel. It's renewable. It gets us out of foreign oil.
Right.
And it's much lower CO2.
With issues of its own. I mean, nice transformation if you can get it, but we're still kind of waiting to see this thing on the lot. We're talking with GM's Vice Chairman for Product Development, Bob Lutz, about the company's great green hope, the Chevy Volt. You can see a photograph of it. Very hot car at our website, onpointradio.org. We'll hear in just a moment from a kind of professional critic of what's going on with GM and the green world. But, Mr. Vice Chairman, we've got a lot of listeners who want to speak with you. Let me begin to turn to them. In Franklin, Connecticut, we've got Carl on the line. Hi, Carl. You're on the air with GM Vice Chairman Bob Lutz.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I just wanted to point out that back in 1977 in junior high, I had to do a report on automobiles, and they were all advertising 27 to 28 city and 30-35 highway. Mm. And of course, nowadays, some of your hybrids are advertising 35, and so it's kind of odd.
After 30 years.
I owned a Mazda 323. They got 42 miles per gallon. And you made mention that the Chafee Initiative that you're at the end of opportunities to expand upon the engine, and which case then the initiative wouldn't matter if they passed it or didn't, because you're going to have to move on to something new. But my thing is that the dollars that you're actually going to lose are one of two things: is either you have R&D dollars that are tied up in creating engines that will get 40, and engines that will get 50, and if you have to jump from the 30 mile an hour engine to the 50 mile an hour engine, you lost the money that you invested in R&D for that 40 mile an hour engine. And I think some of that is where you lose your money. Obviously, the other end of it is that if people know next year you're coming out with an automobile that gets 50 miles per gallon, they're not going to buy what you have in the showrooms this year.
Bob Lutz, what do you say to Carl?
Well, I say to Carl, I say the same thing to him that I say to the Union of Concerned Scientists, who are, I'll accept they may be concerned, but they're certainly not scientists if you look at their academic credentials.
Well, we'll put an asterisk there. I don't know about that. I've talked with some of them. They seem to have pretty good seats in academia. But how about our listener?
I think the most senior one I've met has a bachelor's degree. At any rate, I say the same thing to him. If he has any ideas on technology that will get the internal combustion engine, gasoline or diesel, in a sort of a standard-sized car to 40 miles per gallon or 50 miles per gallon. This is the problem that people have. They think that if we only try a little harder, or that if we tweak something a little bit, or if we reinvent that famous 100-mile carburetor that floated around for decades, which everybody knew was there, along with the razor blade that lasted forever and the runless nylons, and we were somehow conspiring with the oil companies to keep this 100-mile-per-gallon carburetor away from the American public. And these things are urban myths, and there is no known technology other than very expensive hybrid systems, that will get the internal combustion engine, gasoline or diesel, up to anywhere near those figures.
But let me ask you about that skepticism. Yeah. I mean, you know, it didn't grow out of nowhere. You know, you're quoted here. I'm looking at a New York Times story where not long ago you were saying, you know, environmental advocates were just a few nuts in California. Nobody cared about the impact of cars on the environment. Toyota Prius was just a PR stunt, and that you were questioning the existence of global warming. And you're right up at the top of GM on this continent. So is it surprising that people are a little skeptical when you put your plan forward?
No, I don't think so, because there's a difference between having views on what the public buys. And even today, we are still seeing even at $3.30 a gallon,
yep,
we're still seeing very strong sales of full-size pickup trucks. Our new large crossovers, the Acadia, the Outlook, and the Buick Enclave, are sold out and have taken almost a quarter of the segment. So a lot of this, you know, people are scorning large cars and everybody's buying small cars is, to some extent, I would have to say, wishful thinking or misreporting on the part of the press. Mm. Let's not forget that at $3.30 a gallon, the United States public is still paying about half of what per gallon of what the rest of the world pays, and that, by the way, explains the fact that the fuel economy of the fleet in many other countries where they are looking at $6 and $7 per gallon fuel, why the mix of cars is much smaller, and why there are so many cars that get tiny little cars that get 40 and 45 miles
per
gallon.
Yes, but in Carl's defense, it's not exactly just, you know, I don't know, benighted, ignorant consumers. We've got Tom Friedman, the big columnist at the New York Times, talking about, says, those from Michigan who prefer to continue their assisted suicide of the U.S. auto industry by blocking tougher mileage requirements. And then, of course, Bob Lutz, we had not so long ago in your backyard there in Detroit, Barack Obama. He went at the beginning of last month. Let's listen here. He said U.S. automakers need to get serious about pursuing green technology.
Here in Detroit, three giants of American industry are hemorrhaging jobs and profits as foreign competitors answer the rising global demands for fuel-efficient cars. America simply cannot continue on this path.
GM lost $10 billion year before last, $2 billion last year. Is Obama wrong?
I absolutely, resolutely refuse to offer my opinions on either Barack Obama and especially on Professor Tom Friedman.
Oh, what about their, never mind them, what about their points?
I find Professor Friedman,
facetiously
agree
professor,
with
yes,
totally, a person who, in my estimation, distorts and manufactures, and to me is well, I'm just not going to get into it. The fact is, General Motors has over 30 models that get over 30 miles per gallon. In many segments, we are fuel economy leaders. We are not into assisted suicide. At $2.20 a gallon and even at $3 a gallon, we produce what the American public demands. We don't manipulate demand. We've got the Chevrolet Aveo, one of the smallest and most fuel efficient vehicles available in the United States. It sells okay, but there is no ripping demand for that thing. So we have to supply a broad array of vehicles that the American public wants.
We're talking this hour with GM's Vice Chairman for Product Development, Bob Lutz, about the new forthcoming Chevy Volt. You can't buy it yet, but when you can, well, it's a very hot-looking car, and the hope is you'll plug it in and get 100 miles per gallon, maybe plus, on the road. You can see a picture of it at our website, onpointradio.org. We've heard something about the technology, not out until the second half of 2010, and that with a little bit of wing and a prayer, it sounds to us at this point, Bob, but you guys are pushing very hard on it. And will this just be the first of a fleet of electric cars if it works? Do you see a wholesale turnover at GM?
Yeah, I do see possibilities for what we call the E-Flex architecture, which is basically an electric drive system powered purely by electric motors, fed by lithium-ion batteries with some sort of a secondary emergency generator backup system to get you home or to extend your range. So we call it, rather than calling it a plug-in hybrid, it's really what we call a range-extended electric vehicle. Now, that architecture, by architecture we mean the way the vehicle is laid out,
yes,
would be adaptable to larger vehicles, smaller vehicles, minivans, and so forth. But the essential thing to remember is that these are designed to be urban and suburban vehicles optimized for daily trips of 40 to 60 miles. And in the United States, with multiple vehicle ownership, it would not be unreasonable to expect, say, a family to have one or two electric vehicles, and then for the summer vacation trip, you know, they might have a very fuel efficient large sport utility that they wouldn't use very often, but they need it when they need to go on a big trip. And
families doing that already, we've read lately, getting that third car that's very fuel efficient. I want to get a little professional perspective on this, if I may. Bob, let's stand by for just a moment. We're joined from Washington right now by Roland Wong. He's Vehicles Policy Director for the Natural Resources Defense Council. He's been a critic, overall, I'd have to say, of GM's efforts to design fuel-efficient cars. Roland Wong, thanks very much for being with us today. What do you think of the big push on the Volt?
Well, hello, Tom. And first, let me thank you for having me on your show.
Sure.
And earlier, you did ask a very intriguing question, which is, can GM make this turnaround on the environment? And my response to that is, they absolutely can, and they have to, for their own survival. I think GM's been a little bit slow, or a lot of it slow, in recognizing the new realities of the marketplace and of the environment. The realities of the marketplace is that we're living with persistently high gasoline prices in this country, which is going to drive a real change in consumer demand away from gas guzzlers and toward fuel-efficient vehicles. Second reality in this country is that I'm sitting here in Washington today, and we do know the issue of global warming is a critical environmental issue facing this Congress, facing this country, facing this world.
Yeah, we've got those on the table. So here's their initiative. Is this it? Does this, you know, is this the game changer?
No, and there's no the Volt or any single technology is not going to be the savior of any company. It's going to take across-the-board increases in fuel economy and reductions in global warming pollution from every one of their vehicles, since starting immediately, again, for its survival to fit into its new realities of the marketplace.
Bob Lutz says, wait a minute, let's be transformational. Let's not, you know, just nudge along with incremental change here. He wants a transformational offering.
Well, the problem with that argument, of course, is that General Motors has offered this argument previously on their hydrogen fuel cell program. The problem with that, they've also used it as a delay tactic, and that's what they're using. What we see, we see them using the Chevy Volt in a similar manner. Don't make us improve fuel economy. Well, the problem is that improving fuel economy is the cleanest, cheapest, fastest way to reduce petroleum dependency and also cut global warming pollution. And it's necessary. It's necessary for General Motors and other auto companies to reduce their dependency on gas guzzlers, improve the efficiency of every one of the vehicles they build in order to survive in today's market.
Okay, point taken there, but look at this offering in particular then for a minute. Bob Lutz, you know, has painted a picture of it for us. We see what it does, what it doesn't do. It sure looks hot and great. We don't have those batteries in production yet that would be required to make it go, but just weigh it on its merits. The Chevy Volt, the great green hope here, maybe out in 2010. What do you think of it, Roland?
To be an environmental leader, it's not about any kind of single technology. And I'll point to the Chevy Volt. I'll even point to the Toyota Prius. It's not about any single technology. To be an environmental leader, and being an environmental leader in this marketplace also means being competitive. You have to be a leader in the improvements of your overall performance of your fleet. When you look at General Motors, if you look at their overall performance of their fleet, their fuel economy is lower today today than it was 10 years ago.
But pick it up on it. We take that point. You made it before, but pick it up on its merits. If they get it out there in production, in sales rooms, does this help on the environmental issues that your group is concerned about? Does it? Will it work, and will it help?
Every bit helps, but in order to avert dangerous global warming, we need to take immediate action and take big chunks of carbon dioxide pollution out of the air. We can't wait for Chevy Volt or any kind of single technology become to displace the internal combustion gasoline engine. And you know, despite what Mr. Lutz said, according to the National Academy of Sciences, according to the California Air Resources Board, according to many experts, there is plenty of technology to improve today's gasoline vehicles from today's about 25 miles per gallon to about 35 or even 40 miles per gallon
without changing
the size and weight of the fleet.
Yeah, let's pick that up. Bob Lutz, how about it? You hear Roland Wong says, we can't wait, and it's not about transformational. It's about working at it sort of every day, inching that MPG up.
Well, okay. I agree that fuel economy is a priority. We've said that. General Motors has stated that our goal is to be the fuel economy leader in every segment. We are the fuel economy leader in many segments, especially in large vehicles that the American public wants to buy. Look at our full-size pickup trucks. Look at our full-size sport utilities. Look at the new large GMC Acadia Outlook and so forth, Buick Enclave, with absolute segment-leading fuel economy, way better than the Japanese.
In these great big vehicles, but you say that's what they want to buy.
But that's what people want to buy, and you compare them to the equivalent Japanese vehicles, Toyota included. And you want to talk about deteriorating fuel economy over the last 10 or 15 years, at least with the shift to larger vehicles, we've offset that with technological improvements. You look at the imports, especially Toyota, their fuel economy has actually tanked as they've gone up in the market. Well, they can't go up in the market fast enough with larger and larger sport utilities, culminating in the Toyota Tundra pickup truck. And then on global warming, let's get one thing straight.
Okay.
I am sick and tired of hearing this thing about the cars and trucks contribute 20% of global CO2. They do not. They contribute 0.4 of 1% to CO2, which means you could immobilize every car and truck on the planet today, and you would save less than 0.5%. Now, where does this 20% figure come from? Well, they say 2% of CO2 is man-made, and 0.4% is 20% of the 2%. So, okay, I'll buy that. But to sort
of—that's what
matters,
isn't it? Well, I mean, we can't control what nature does. We can control what humans do.
That's right, and we all agree it's an issue, and we all agree it's a focal point. There's just to believe that we will reduce total CO2 by 20%. By regulating cars and trucks. What about the fleet that's already out there? You can't touch it. A lot of these cars are going to be in operation for another 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, Bob, I've just got Roland for another minute here. You got some big points there. Roland Wong, how about it? They do great, Bob Lutz says, on fuel economy, on the cars Americans want to buy. And hey, by the way, lay off cars and trucks. That's not the be-all and end-all of this issue.
To solve global warming, the United States is going to have to get its act in gear and enact mandatory controls on greenhouse gases. The United States is still the leader in global warming emissions globally. So when it comes to taking action, we can't ignore tailpipes, because in this country, the United States, passenger vehicles are 20% of the total man-made emissions of carbon dioxide pollution. So we have to tackle these tailpipes, and we have to do it immediately.
Do you see the U.S. auto industry getting its hands around the environmental problem, and do you see GM and others surviving and thriving as the importance of that appears to grow?
The choice is up to the automakers, individual companies, of whether they want to choose to thrive in a world where there will be new environmental controls on global warming pollution. This debate reminds us a lot of the 1970s, where the auto industry fought tooth and nail against new catalytic converter requirements which was necessary in order to clear up smoggy skies across this country. That was a big debate. The auto industry denied denied that there was technology available, denied that their vehicles contributed substantially to the problem. Well, we know the history of smog. We know the history of the catalytic converter. Tremendous success story. History is repeating itself at this time. I believe that in the next comeback in a year or two, this debate will be somewhat academic because this country will have moved on and moved forward to mandatory greenhouse gas controls on smokestacks and tailpipes.
Well, that'll be a different picture indeed if and when it comes. Roland Wong at the Natural Resources Defense Council, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Vice Chairman Bob Lutz, lots of people want to talk with you. Let me go to Columbia, South Carolina, and Gary. Gary, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
We're good.
What I've noted is back in the 70s, we had cars that were gas hogs. Technology came along in the 80s. We started building fuel-efficient cars. Lo and behold, all of a sudden, we looked at CAFE standards, and GM, Chrysler, and Ford all of a sudden said, oh, wait a minute, let's go to the truck segment. Let's build up the SUV, i.e. truck, and let's push that on the American public. In turn, we're not really building anything that's, you know, drawing the American public to them. We'll just keep pushing and marketing.
What do you mean? Bob Lutz says that's what Americans want. That's what they put their cash down for.
That's what they put out there. That was the only thing out there. Why instead out building cars? They built cars all along. They built cars.
Well, but, you know, maybe. We'll get Bob Lutz's reaction. Let me get one more call first. Mike from Savannah, Georgia. Mike, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I tuned in just as Mr. Lutz was giving his blanket insult of all scientists with a bachelor's degree, and with his numbers from global warming, I'd like to know what his degree in environmental science is. Yeah. And I'd also like to thank him for the amazing view into the arrogance of American automotive industry. And thank you for all the insults you've been giving and the amazing stupidity you've been spouting.
Wow, what would you got zero confidence in your corner, Mike? I mean, they want to survive and thrive.
After listening to Mr. Lutz, it's just amazing the incompetence that our leadership in American industry has.
Well, okay, right on the chin, Bob Lutz. And you heard Gary earlier saying this isn't what Americans want to buy. It's what Detroit is pushing, the big cars. What do you say to that criticism?
Well, this is something that's been around for decades, in that the people who have no relationship with business and who have never been in marketing or in industry believe that companies can manipulate demand. You know, I wish it were true. There's a lot of stuff out there that we would like to sell that is not selling. And fundamentally, in a free market society, people buy what they want. And there isn't enough advertising money in the world to make them change their mind if it's something that we don't want. If the Pontiac Aztec would have been a huge success if we had been able to manipulate the American public. Unfortunately, we weren't able to make anybody like it. And at General Motors, check the press about 10 years ago. General Motors was behind in trucks. Chrysler and Ford had placed huge bets on trucks. The whole American business press, Time magazine, everybody was saying those stupid guys at General Motors, asleep at the switch again, have missed America's shift to trucks.
And SUVs and all the rest, yeah.
Exactly. General Motors asleep again. So we were late to the truck party, and we were criticized for being late to the truck party. Now I'm hearing criticism that we I mean, the whole notion that a company can put out something and force the public to buy it is just preposterous.
A lot of questions I can't get to, but up here on the screen about the EV1 electric car that got then pulled back. GM put it out there, pulled it back, and crushed most of them, I read. Why?
Well, the EV1 was a vehicle that, frankly, we couldn't sell. We tried and tried to sell it. We couldn't. We finally put it out on lease. We had to drop the lease price several times to get people to take them. And there was a very, very small, numbering in the hundreds, faction of mostly Hollywood personalities who grew very fond of the vehicle. But at some point during our period of financial stress, General Motors had to cut losses wherever we could. And maintaining this tiny little fleet of two-passenger EV1s was becoming a very onerous financial problem for us. So we decided to call the vehicles in. They were our own property. We had every right to bring them
because
in.
Because they were leased, yep. And
yeah,
down they
were
went.
Leased, and the leases were expired. And because it's a vehicle that requires a great deal of maintenance and care and operate under very high voltage and so forth,
yep.
We did not want these vehicles leaking back out into the public. And we our legal folks recommended that they be crushed.
We've just got a minute here. Let me ask you just a personal question. I mean, you know, Maximum Bob is the nickname. You love cars.
Yeah.
It's clear from your history.
Yeah.
And you like big ones. I mean, the Dodge Viper, look at that sucker. A 1,000 horsepower Cadillac you wanted. Do you hate, you know, messing around with these low-mileage cars?
No, not at all. You know, I also, when I was at Chrysler, I was also the driving force behind the Neon. When I was at Ford of Europe, we did the Ford Fiesta. I love cars of all kinds. It's just that when we had $1.25 a gallon, Americans aspired to big cars with lots of horsepower because the fuel bill didn't matter. You'll notice that when we repeated the sort of Viper impact thing at General Motors, we did it with the four-cylinder Pontiac Solstice and Saturn Sky, which are highly fuel-efficient sports cars, very affordable and selling extremely well.
Well, there you
go. So I'm not wedded to high horsepower and vehicles that consume a lot of gasoline.
Bob Lutz, Vice Chairman of General Motors for Product Development, talking today about the forthcoming, we hope, Chevy Volt. Thank you very much for being with us. Listeners, you can continue the conversation at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.